Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David Latulipe. My guests this week include actor-playwright Brian Copeland, who returns to talk about his latest show at The Marsh, The Waiting Period. Rachel Rosen shares celluloid news and the digital equivalents thereof that will be part of the 59th San Francisco International Film Festival. 42nd Street Moon artistic director Greg McKellen, if he can get off the Bay Bridge, will be here to discuss their production of The Boys from Syracuse. And Peter Nachtrieb discusses House Tour, a new comedy at Z-Space. Stay with us. My first guest, Brian Copeland, has been in show business since he first stepped on the comedy stage at age 18. Before long, he was headlining clubs and concerts across the country and opening for such artists as Smokey Robinson, The Temptations, Ringo Starr, and Aretha Franklin, among others, in venues from the Universal Amphitheater to Constitution Hall in Washington, D.C. Copeland then branched off into TV, appearing on comedy programs on NBC, Comedy Central, A&E, and MTV. Here in the Bay Area, Copeland is a fixture in broadcasting, where he has hosted programs on just about every television station, including KTVU for a five-year stint as co-host of Mornings on 2, ABC 7, host of the Emmy Award-winning 7 Live, and KNTV, with the special Now Brian Copeland. Since 1995, he's been heard on KGO, Radio AM 810, and The Brian Copeland Show remains the most listened to program in its Sunday afternoon time slot, reaching some 100,000 viewers or so, listeners or so.
Well, viewers, they can watch the radio.
Yeah, viewers, they can watch
indeed,
the radio.
Indeed, yeah, just hold. On stage, Brian has been involved with his first one-man play, Not a Genuine Black Man, back in 2004 at The Marsh in San Francisco. The play explored his childhood experiences as a member of one of the only African-American families living in a then 94% white suburb of San Leandro. That show became the longest-running solo show in San Francisco theatrical history, with over 800 performances, subsequently performed in over 30 cities across the country, and recently enjoyed a revival here in San Francisco, which I think is the last time we talked.
Yeah.
An additional solo plays include the hit Christmas show, The Jewelry Box, and The Scion, and he's working on a new play, Grandma and Me, an ode to single parents. He's been back at The Marsh since January with a play that won the 2015 Theater Bay Area Award for Outstanding Production of a Solo Play, The Waiting Period. Brian, an honor and a pleasure to have you back in our humble studios.
I think we have nothing left to talk about.
We're
out of time, aren't we?
Well, with a resume like this, it's hard to think of the subject matter of this play, which we're going to talk about a bit. The term waiting period, of course, refers to the time between I want to purchase a gun, and you've got to wait 10 days before you get that
gun. In the state of California.
In the state of California.
Yes,
okay.
There's a 10-day waiting period from the time that you purchase a gun to when you can get it. So what the waiting period is about is it is about a very bad suicidal bout of depression that I went through in 2008. And I should kind of give you the background of this show. If you've seen Not a Genuine Black Man, I touch on a bad bout of depression that I had in 1999. And some of the critics who wrote about that show said that they would have been interested in seeing me go more in depth with that, since it's not something that we really talk about. So I kind of played with the idea. 2004 was when Genuine came out. I kind of thought about it for a while. Then 2008, I went through this bad bout. And afterwards, I thought, maybe I should talk about this. And I played around with it until the nephew of a good friend of mine laid down on the railroad tracks up in Oakley, 15-year-old kid.
Wow.
And I thought, you know what? I need to talk about this, because maybe if I can talk about this openly, that it will encourage other people to talk about it before they get to that place.
Well, I understand that Robin Williams' suicide was also an inspiration for you.
Well, that's after. Just in terms of background. So the play opened in 2012, and it ran for about a year and a half. And I had to stop. because I couldn't do that many performances a week as I was doing. Because in order for the depression to be real for the audience, it's got to be real for me. And as an actor, I have to go to that place. And it started to pull me back in.
Wow.
And so I stopped. Wow. So I stopped. And so then we go to August of 2014, and Robin committed suicide. And, you know, all of us in the comedy community, we all knew Robin. You do comedy in the Bay Area, you know Robin. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to talk about this again. So I brought it back in the fall of 2014, and I've been doing it at the Marsh ever since.
Well, you know, as I mentioned in the intro, reading your bio, one can't help but think, now, how is this guy depressed? And I can think therein lies the kernel of what little we know about what depression and serious depression is all about.
Well, see, that's the point of why I'm talking about this is, I mean, I'm the last person that people would think would go through it. And I'm trying to spread the word that it is a disease and that you have no control over the fact that it's not your fault that you suffer from this disease. You know, and the stigma that we have around depression is something that we've got to eliminate in this society. You would not be ashamed if you had Lou Gehrig's disease. You would not be ashamed if you had cancer, if you had just about any other disease. But for some reason, we look at this disease as being a character flaw.
Right, right. And it's safe to say that I think everyone has been affected by depression or the further manifestation of some sort of a suicide attempt or some family member or friend. I'm thinking back to my days at Ithaca College. We lost a clarinet professor, you know, wonderful guy. You know, one day he's here and next day he's not. Here at KLW, we lost a part-time announcer when I first started at the station to suicide. And therein, I think, lies the problem with people that maybe contemplating suicide. I think you and I have both been in that situation where we're thinking, this is my choice. This is going to make things better for everyone, isn't it? But it doesn't for the people that remain behind.
Right. And I would even go farther than saying it's my choice, because you're not in your right mind, first of all. And the analogy I like to use is imagine somebody took a dagger and they stuck it in your shoulder all the way up to the bone, okay? And then they start to twist it. And twisted and twisted. And after a while, all you feel is that pain. Now figure somebody comes up to you and says, all right, you know what? If with your free hand, if you'll drink this bottle of strychnine, that pain will go away. You know, how much could you take before you reach for the strychnine? You know, that's the analogy that I like to use. So what I'm trying to, and I should mention that this is a show about depression, but it's not a depressing show. That's the thing. There is as much humor in this as there is, you know, depth and as many somber moments. David Ford, who's my director and collaborator, we worked very, very hard on getting the rhythm of this show down, because we didn't want this to be something that if you deal with this, it's going to make you, it's going to be so hard for you to watch that you can't handle it. So what I basically do is I had gone through a series of calamities that in 2008 that brought me to this place. My grandmother, who raised me, suddenly died. I had a wife take off with me, leaving me with three kids by myself. I had a serious car accident that almost left me a quadriplegic. And then I had to have spinal cord surgery, and I was laid up for 3 months in a neck brace, all within a couple month period of time. Okay, and so I've suffered from depression.
I should have Gloria Gaynor's I Will Survive after all that, boy. Well,
and so that's what brought me there. So what I do is I take you by the hand and I show you what's going on in the mind of a depressive during that period of time, as well as what people on the outside are saying. My daughter, who was 16 at the time, and she's trying to reach me and can. And the friends who say, oh, come on, you know, look at, you could be in Darfur right now. You could be starving. You could be on the street. You're so lucky. You know, all the things people say, and you wouldn't try to talk somebody out of having cancer. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
you wouldn't
try.
You got leukemia. Come on, shake it off.
Yeah,
the sun's shining outside. Shake it off.
Yeah.
So I also interviewed people who deal with who have dealt with this issue, and I tell their stories in this as well. And what's really cool is that there have been people who have told me that they were there, and they saw the show and they went and got help. There is a gentleman who is an Iraq war vet who said that after seeing the show, he was able to get help, and it gave him the courage to go and talk to somebody, so he was able to it saved his family is what it is he says. Because that's the message is tell somebody. Message, if I can stand up here and I can spill my guts to strangers for 75 minutes, you can go and tell somebody you were having thoughts that are not in your best interest.
You're dedicating each one of these shows to a family or someone that's been affected by
Well, we did that when we first brought it back. Okay. I was dedicating each show to someone who someone who'd been lost or family who'd lost someone. But what's interesting is we put it out just if you want me to dedicate a show, send me a name. We didn't get many because of the stigma. Mm-hmm. People did not want the world to know that they lost a family member to suicide. But what we're doing now is there's a project that we started back in January. Actually, we started fundraising for it last summer. We're trying to raise enough money to run this play free to the public every Sunday for a year. Every Sunday for a year. Reason being is we have an epidemic of depression and suicide among young people, high school kids, college kids, who can't afford $30 to $100 for a ticket. And the March can't just let me do it for free because they need the money to keep the lights on.
Sure.
So we've been doing this. We're basically trying to raise enough money to basically buy out every single seat in the house for a year. And so far we've raised enough to run it for free through May. We started in January. We ran it for free through May. So, yeah, there are tickets available. You just go online to themarsh.org, and you reserve them just like you would purchase tickets. And, you know, until the house is full, or you can take your chances and just walk up at the door and come on in.
Right.
And the other issue is, you know, we're asking for contributions. It's all tax deductible. If you can help us out, you know, you can go to themarsh.org, briancopeland.com. There's a link, and you've got the GoFundMe link, which I don't have in front of me.
Right. GoFundMe.com/XKNYTK. We won't make you memorize that. We'll put a link on our website for the open air page for that GoFundMe campaign. Well, it's so noble that you're offering this for free and that it's able to reach so many people.
Well, how many times in your life do you get to do something where you can literally say you saved somebody's life? And the emails I get from people and the letter. One of the first letters I got that made me cry was this woman who brought her husband kicking and screaming. You know, he didn't want to go sit through this. And he never got her depression, never wanted to hear about it, didn't want to, come on, just, you know, snap, one of those snap out of it kind of people. So he goes and he sits through the show, and on the ride home to her, he says, okay, is that what you go through? And she said, of their 15-year marriage, he never wanted to hear about it, never wanted to talk about it, and he was able to have the conversation with her. Other letter I got that just blew my mind. They might have sent this one to you. Gentleman whose girlfriend, same thing, dragged him. She deals with depression. He doesn't. Oh, God, fine, I'll go with you through this because you want to go. He sits there and he watches the show, and he starts to see his brother. He starts to see behavior that his brother goes through. So he calls his mom and his mom and his sisters, and they all tell him that they have received presents from the brother, things that meant a lot to him. You know, he'd gotten his brother's, I think it was baseball card collection that when they were kids, his brother wouldn't let him touch. And he'd say, I want you to have this. And they all did like an intervention, and they found out he was, you know, those were goodbye gifts.
Wow.
And he said, had he not gone to the show, he wouldn't have thought anything about it. And so they got him help. Apparently he's doing fine. He's in a relationship and all these things, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's just, it's for a lot of people, this has been a life-changing experience. And for that, I mean, that's a gift to me, mm-hmm. You know.
Fantastic. So let's back up to your own waiting period.
Okay.
When you decided to purchase that gun.
Yeah.
What was going on during those 10 days?
Well, as I said, it was a 32 Beretta Tomcat was the gun. And it was a 10-day waiting period in order to get it. And during the 10 days, it's all of these things. You know, I went through, you know, all of the things, the feelings of being worthless and just the pain that's so bad. And see, that's the thing a lot of people don't get. I mean, the depths of the pain are different depending on the individual. For me, it got so bad that I couldn't get out of bed. Got so bad I couldn't move. Got so bad that at one point, I mean, I felt physical pain. You know, there's a part in the show where I say, God, even my hair hurts right now. And there's something where I had an epiphany that was the beginning of the road back that got me, when I finally reached out and it brought me to the place to where I was able to you know, live on to fight another day. I don't want to give that away because that's, you know, I don't want to tell you that Rosebud's the sled. Oh, spoiler. Sorry if I ruined that for you. Sorry about that.
We've got a film segment right after this. Yes.
If you're watching the OJ miniseries, I won't give away how it ends.
Yeah. So, you mentioned that the show is physically taxing for you, so you must have something that you do that snaps you back.
Well, I can do it once a week.
Okay.
So I said, I can do it once a week. 6-7 performances a week, mm-mm. Mm-hmm. I did it for a year and a half, and it was just, as I said, in the parts of that play where I'm depressed, I go there. I mean, as an actor, I really go there, and I try to feel what it is that I felt at that moment, because if it looks like I'm acting, you're not going to buy it.
Mm.
You know, and I can do that once a week. I can do that once a week, and then, you know, I shake it off, and, you know, I have a little process I go through before and after mm-hmm. that keeps me healthy and makes it okay. But this is, yeah.
And what about those that say, well, you know, I don't want to just be on some sort of a medication that makes me happy. I mean, the reality of life has its ups and downs. Is my cure to depression going to be being addicted to whatever, Prozac,
well,
whatever?
See, here's the thing, and it really depends on the individual. I'm not on any medication that makes me happy. What the difference is I'm the king of analogies when it comes to this. When most, let's say you're on that normal for you is a 10th story of a building. Okay, when people who don't have this disease get depressed or go through the blues, everybody does. It's part of being human. Instead of being on the 10th floor, you're on the 7th floor. Me, instead of being on the 7th floor, I'm in the basement. And what the medication that I take does is it brings me, when I'm depressed, I'm on the 7th floor instead of in the basement.
Mm-hmm.
That's
mm-hmm.
all.
Right.
I mean, I'm not, you know, up on the 10th or in the attic, okay. You know, when I'm on it. It's just, you know, it evens me out. It makes me normal.
Mm-hmm. Well, you've been broadcasting for some time now. Mm-hmm. We talked about this a little bit off the air. Are you ever have a little bit of anxiety prior to going on the air, either on TV or radio? Is it a matter of preparation?
I get antsy sometimes, like anxious to go on. Same thing like on stage. But the only time when I'll get a little flustered is, I've told you this on my program, if I've got a guest who, if it's, you know, I get on right about 105, you know, if it's 104 and my guest isn't there, or I've got a phoner, your producer Snicker, and he's seen this movie before, or it's 104 and I've got a phoner that has not called in, then I get nervous.
Yeah.
Then it's like, oh man, I got to dance now until.
Funny, I just got a call from one of my guests, Greg McKellen, who might still be on the Bay Bridge. That's due this hour for 42nd Street Moon. Oh, he's here.
He's here.
Glad to hear it, and we're glad you're here, Brian. Sort of an open-ended run of The Waiting Period is at The Marsh, themarsh.org for more information. BrianCopeland.com, Brian, Copeland.com, or for all things Brian. And we'll have a link to the GoFundMe.com link, which is making possible these free performances at The Marsh.
Well, I want to mention, too, if I can, just that right now, as I said, we've raised enough money to provide it for free through May. Hopefully, we'll raise enough to do it for the year. If not, the show, I'm committed to doing this show for a year. So if we run out of money, then we'll just have to charge the public, but I'm hoping that it doesn't get to that.
Okay. I should also mention that the shows are Sundays at 5:30.
Sundays at 5:30.
Thanks again for coming in, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
And with that iconic theme, we enter the film segment of our program. The 59th San Francisco International Film Festival gets underway mid-month ahead, April 21st through May 5th, with some 173 films being offered up at 10 different venues in town, including the new Alamo Drafthouse on Mission Street at 22nd Street, and a foray into Berkeley at the brand spanking new Banff, the UC Berkeley's Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive on Center Street. Joining me to talk about the festival is Rachel Rosen, the director of programming for the festival and for the San Francisco Film Society at large. She's done similar work for Film Independent and the Los Angeles Film Festival, and has worked in various capacities for the New York Film Festival, New York's Film Forum, and TriStar Pictures. She's a Stanford grad and a director in her own right. Her short documentary, Serious Weather, was screened here as well as at festivals in Vancouver and England. Rachel, welcome to Open Air.
Thanks for having me.
Well, film festival numbers are always a staggering thing to look at. And it's kind of just fun facts that not only the 173 films, but 74 shorts in 39 languages, including two world premieres, and 50 women directors are among the interesting numbers of the festival.
Yeah, I mean, at the San Francisco International Film Festival, our goal is to show a really wide and diverse selection of films from around the world, something that will appeal to all different kinds of our diverse city of San Francisco. So that includes lots of different kinds of films, everything from animated family films to our dark wave section for those that like something a little darker and scarier, Big Things at the Castro, and little intimate masterclasses. Well, we kind of try and cover the waterfront.
Well, give us a little insight into what a programmer does on for a festival of this scale. I mean, the 173 films that made the cut, so to speak, are just the tip of the iceberg, I'm sure, of what was submitted for consideration.
Yeah, you know, to the short answer is we watch movies for a living. We get over 3,000 submissions to the festival. The festival's the oldest festival in the Americas, so we have a lot of history and good relationships with filmmakers that have gone back a long time, and also reach out to new filmmakers every year. We have a youth section, so the young filmmakers can also apply. And so starting in September, we just start watching movies and talking about them and talking to filmmakers and distributors and producers about things they might have and programs we might be able to put on here, and then just fitting it all together into something.
Right. You have a popcorn sponsor then for all of these screenings?
No, come on. We have alcohol.
Okay, well, at least a wine sponsor would be nice. So then you get down to the finalists, so to speak. How is it? What kind of a panel do you have that says, okay, this is a go, this is a no?
We have a team of programmers that's four people, and we make a lot of the decisions. Our executive director is a former programmer from the Toronto Film Festival, so we are really fortunate that he also does a lot of the heavy lifting.
Good, a lot of playbooks from pages from his playbook. Maybe.
Exactly, and a lot of very good filmmaker friends that he can call on to come visit us. And between us, we just talk, and it's not exactly consensus. I mean, if someone really feels passionately about something that the others don't like, that's probably a good sign that it might be something we should consider showing. And we just try and keep a balance, as I said, so that we make sure we have as broad a selection as we can.
Mm-hmm. The festival also includes what's called screenings of the masters. How does that work into the scheduling of the film festival?
Well, you know, if a couple of years ago we used to just lay out all the films from A to Z, and 2 years ago we decided to break the festival into sections. And the sections don't really change the way we program the festival, but they're there to help the audience find the films that will interest them. So, you know, for instance, if you want to see a glamorous big screening with movie stars, then you go to one of the big nights, opening or closing. Go to our opening night, you get to see Kate Beckinsale. The master section is for really the art house film masters from around the world. A lot of the names in that section are directors that our audiences will be familiar with. So, for example, Barbara Koppel, the wonderful documentary filmmaker, we gave her an award a couple years ago, and she's back with her new film, Miss Sharon Jones, about the singer Sharon Jones and her musical career and battle with cancer. But also archival presentations are in the master section. So, you know, the 30th anniversary of Aliens is part of that section.
Oh, fun.
Exactly.
Maybe catch that.
And then we have our Golden Gate Awards competition, which is more for if you're looking to see who the masters of the future will be, that's the place to go, because they're that competition is for emerging filmmakers. So for the features, it's people's first narrative feature. And the documentaries, they may have made a few, but they're probably not household names.
Well, speaking of more of a household name and a master himself, Werner Herzog has a feature film in a section called Marquee Presentations, his Lo and Behold. Let's hear him in the flesh, so to speak, and then we'll talk about that film as well as some other global offerings of the festival.
Pittsburgh. The industrial age, the steel mills are long gone. A new industry has established itself. Here, robots are being designed. This one named Chimp is testing its limbs on its own.
You could essentially, in the not too distant future, tweet thoughts.
I can not only imagine artificial intelligence evolving spontaneously on the internet, but I can't tell you that it hasn't happened already. Because it wouldn't necessarily reveal itself to us.
My dishwasher came to me and said, look, I'm falling in love with your refrigerator. And as a result, I have no time to wash your dishes. I wouldn't like that dishwasher.
Will our children's children's children need the companionship of humans? Or will they have evolved in a world where that's not important?
The voice of Werner Herzog and the people in his movie, Lo and Behold. It sounds like a fascinating offering.
Yeah, and in some ways it's very much illustrative of the kind of films we have in the festival because, I mean, we're all here in the center of a lot of things going on with new technology, and it's he brings his very particular perspective to something. And, you know, so the movie allows you to sort of take a step back and see it from a different perspective than you would see it in your day-to-day life. And the festival's full of films like that where there are people talking about their own cultures or experiencing other people's cultures in a way that just gives us a fresh perspective on a whole number of things.
And you also mentioned that these big nights are kind of bookending the festival.
Yeah, we have a big opening, closing, and centerpiece performances. The opening is called Love and Friendship. It's by Whit Stillman. He's an American independent director, but it's based on a Jane Austen novella and stars Kate Beckinsale as one of his, maybe less likable female heroines, but you find her quite likable in the end anyway.
Well, full film descriptions of everything happening for the 59th San Francisco International Film Festival. Well, before I offer that website, I'll offer it a couple times, sffs.org. Tell me a little bit about the global visions. When one thinks about the globe at this point, one thinks that all the films have got to be about some sort of war conflict. Are you going beyond the obvious in some of the selections of global interest?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Global Visions is really like the heart and soul of the festival, and it's just a look at international film production for the year. But we have all sorts of unique and really interesting takes on world events. We have a film, it's actually not in Global Visions, but in the festival, it's an Afghanistan war story, but it has a supernatural element to it.
Oh, all right.
Yeah, nice, exactly.
Okay. Read about that film and others at sffs.org. Difficult letters to say on the radio, sffs.org. Rachel Rosen, Director of Programming for the 59th Festival, thanks so much for taking some time today. We look forward to the festival.
Oh, thanks so much for having us on.
A touch of music from birthday boy Herb Alpert, his classic Spanish Flea from Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass. We'll hear more from Herb before this hour of Open Air is out. We'll also hear from Greg McKellen about the 42nd Street Moon, production of The Boys from Syracuse. Well, at Z-Space, through the end of April, you can enjoy a tour, not of the wonderful Z-Space play spaces themselves, but a house tour of the infamous Porter family mansion with tour guide Weston Ludlow-Londonderry. as portrayed by Danny Shay.
Danny Shay,
all right, S-C-H-E-I-E. This immersive comedic experience was created by my guest playwright Peter Sinnaktrebe and is directed by Jason Egan. Peter joins me in studio to talk about the work. He's a native of exotic Marin County.
I know, it's a lot of trees.
Survived the childhood bullying experiences and parts in school musicals to later get a degree in, of all things, biology and theater from Brown University, returning to the Bay Area and San Francisco State for a master's in creative writing. He counts Encore Theater Company, Killing My Lobster, the Marin Theater Company, Playwrights Foundation, ACT, and Z-Space, where he is in a three-year term as at the Mellon Playwright in Residence, as organizations and groups that have embraced him as a playwright.
I feel very loved. I'm very embraced.
Well, welcome to our studios.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I also want to talk about your play, Boom, about the end of days, which I guess had simultaneous performances in 12 different cities across the country at one point.
Yeah, it had a bunch of productions around 2009 and 2010 and has had over about 100 productions around the country since then.
And it's
that sort of the fusing of my biology and theater degrees into one play. It was about a marine biologist luring a female journalism student down to his subterranean research lab that's suspiciously well-stocked right before a comet hits the planet. And sort of a journey into their relationship to see whether they'll actually save and rescue humanity.
that's got some legs now that it's been published through what's the
publisher? Dramatis Play Service.
That's
so
great.
Yeah, so they licensed the play out too, and it's been done at colleges and lots of community theaters and professional theaters, and then it's starting to occasionally make its place around the world. So it's had productions in Munich. Kuala Lumpur did a production, which was pretty amazing. And I wish I saw pictures, but I didn't get to see the show.
Well, I've been reading about some of your other play titles, including Bob, Colorado, TIC, which stands for Trenchcoat in Common, and Fall Springs, a Musical Disaster.
Yes.
And some of your plays have been termed dark comedy, I see a lot.
Yeah, they're all generally funny, I think, and hopefully with some weight and depth underneath it. And I'm always sort of asking questions, and for me it's always been asking them through comedy, and it's sort of been a way for me to get intimate with an audience and to sort of disarm an audience, as well as sort of my natural approach to life and the world is through a sense of humor. But and then the play A House Tour, it's definitely that's sort of the journey of the play. It's very funny, and Danny Shay is one of the funniest actors you'll ever meet, and the fact that you're touring with him, and really he's right directly just feet away from you.
We should mention that you're not going to be sitting down for this production.
No, we've kind of reimagined the space. Z-Space is a 12,000 square foot former can factory, part of the Project Arto complex in the Mission, and we've actually pulled up the seats and we've created a walkthrough theatricalized version of a mansion that you'll be walking and journeying and sometimes sitting, but often not sitting. So it's a very sort of immersive experience, much like an actual house tour.
Well, instead of dark comedy, this is being termed dirty immersive.
It's a little dirty, yes. I mean, the character Weston seems to be trapped in an endless double entendre situation where everything he says is clearly about something else, and usually it's about something kind of filthy.
Okay.
Yes, which is what I think it's the sweet spot of Danny Shay as an actor as well. He's able to make you have some sort of dirty image in your mind, even though the words he's saying sound sort of innocent. So it's kind of he kind of brings you into this world where hopefully everyone feels a little gooey inside.
Okay. So PG-13 or more immersive for folks coming.
Yeah, a very seasoned PG-13. I mean, a 13-year-old with access to the internet, I'm sure will be fine at this point. Maybe traumatized a little bit. Okay. But, you know, that's always good for everybody, just a little.
Well, tell me about the inspiration for this play.
Part of it was, thematically, was trying to explore just outsiders and outsiderness. And as a gay man, now that parts of our culture are getting more and more open and welcome, is it the right choice to choose normalcy if you don't want to?
Right,
and it's a
right,
sort of a celebration of someone finding power in being abnormal and his And the couple of the mansion that he's touring is also another couple that sort of celebrated their outsiderness. So it's sort of a tribute to that that kind of feeling of being on the outside and sort of owning it. And I guess it's also in some way it's maybe where the pleasure of doing things that other people find shameful is also sort of what the play is about.
Interesting. How did you find Danny?
Danny and I worked on a show together several years ago called Bob, which premiered at the Humana Festival in Louisville, Kentucky. And he was in a reading here in San Francisco, and then he came with me to do the production, the premiere production there. And it was just a moment where, as a writer, I just absolutely fell in love with his voice and what he did with my words. And I think I knew at that moment that I would love to write a play for him. And as this character was emerging, I just had fragments of this character. I was actually writing the character in Weston, Vermont, and developing it. And Ludlow and Londonderry are nearby towns.
Oh, and, right. Sure, yeah. So from New England myself.
Yeah. So the name emerged, and then and Danny's voice was just burning in my brain. And I approached him 2 years ago to see if he would be interested in me writing a play for him. And he said yes. And it's been an incredible journey. I've been bringing in sort of fragments of work over the last 2 years. We did a workshop. We worked at the ground floor at Berkeley Rep this summer. Great. And so it's been this process where I've been really creating it for him to perform. And it's a really special experience. And I think only because I'm a resident playwright at Z-Space, that was where I'm on salary and I'm there and with the great support of Lisa Steinler, the artistic director there. She trusted me to bring him in so much and work with him and grow this piece slowly and carefully and ridiculously, I guess.
Well, let's talk about that residency. You're the Mellon playwright. Is that the chief's funder, I imagine?
Yes. So
what does that mean?
It means we together, Z-Space and I, received a grant from the Andrew Mellon Foundation for me to be a salaried playwright in residence. So I have a desk. A desk and money
and a chair
and a paycheck and a chair. Yes,
pencil
they
or
give
two.
Me occasionally pencils. They give me limited access to the printer because I abused it, so I got punished. I'm just kidding. And, I go to the staff meetings. I'm sort of trying to see what it means to be what an artist can do to us. How we can contribute to his staff and in the marketing department, the development department, being part of all of those discussions has been really enriching for me, as well as I hope I can offer a perspective to organization as a whole.
So are you working on a particular project as that playwright in residence, or is it more just a nurturing of the environment and those around you?
It's a bit of both. I'm allowed to do whatever I want. This play, though, is definitely a result. I've actually just been renewed for another 3 years. So
great.
This was the result of the first three.
Nice.
and it became because of it, I was able to pick an actor as my starting point to work to write a play, as well as wanting to write a play for the actual physical building that I was in, which is unique and huge and has so much potential. So I was able to marinate in the theater that I was writing for, and I've never written a play like this that's on its feet and moving around, and it's a big risk for me. And that's sort of what I think being in residence means, is I'm able to take risks.
Interesting.
That I maybe couldn't do.
Yeah, speaking back to the immersive nature of this, I imagine you've got to have a limited number of people that you can allow into the theater if they're all going to be following the actor. Around.
Yeah, we thought we were going to do about 40. We had about 50 people last night, which seems to be about our maximum for some of the rooms. And so it's a very intimate experience. And sometimes you're in some spaces where you'll be in contact with your other your fellow. It becomes a community experience. You grow and you begin to trust him as a guide, as well as you're going to depend on each other to have a good time. It's very fun, I will say too, and we're not too mean to you during the show.
And the run is through, I don't have the date.
It's through April 23rd.
Through April 23rd, yeah. At zspace.org for all things going on there. Always fascinating what the different things that are going on. That's a beehive of activity.
It's
really
a
is.
Dreamy place to be, because every weekend there's something different going on. Mm-hmm. And it's an eclectic big tent place that you can just go any weekend, you'll see something interesting and different from the thing you saw before.
a house tour of the infamous Porter family mansion with tour guide Weston Ludlow Londonderry, played by Danny Shea at ZSpace, zspace.org for more information. Playwright Peter Sinnacktreeve, thanks so much for coming in to talking about.
Thanks for having me. Yeah. It's very beautiful.
Looking forward to catching this.
Oh, good. Yes.
Falling in love with love is falling for make-believe. Falling in love with love is playing the fool. Caring too much is such a juvenile fancy. Learning to trust is just for children in school. I fell in love with love one night when the moon was full. I was unwise with eyes unable to see. I fell in love with love, with love everlasting, but love fell out with me.
That's a tune from the Rodgers and Hart musical, The Boys from Syracuse. One of several memorable tunes that have worked its way into the Great American Songbook. Of course, Sammy Davis Jr. and that iconic big band sound there. The 1938 musical, based on Shakespeare's The Comedy of Errors, was adapted by librettist George Abbott. Shakespeare's Comedy of Errors itself was loosely based on an earlier, much earlier play, we should definitely say, a Roman play, The Twin Brothers by Plautus. It's a prime candidate for the good folks at 42nd Street Moon and their production at the Eureka Theater, which runs through April 17th, and is the swan song final directing project, I hear, for director Greg McKellen, who joins me in studio. Greg is founding artistic director of 42nd Street Moon, whose career in musical theater extends back more than 30 years. And during his time just at the Moon, he's directed more than 50 musicals, adapting the scripts for many of them. He's also a UCLA grad and a highly regarded musical theater historian of note for many projects. And it's thanks to Greg's vision that Bay Area audiences have been treated to such wonderful musical theater treasures as The Boys from Syracuse. Always a pleasure to welcome back to our airwaves, Greg.
Thanks, David. It's always great to be here.
Now, what is this I'm hearing about final directing project? What gives there?
Well, it's true. This is my final book musical. I'm doing we have a thing called a salon, two performances in May, focusing on Julie Stein's music. So I am doing that, but this is my final book musical. I am leaving. I'm retiring from 42nd Street Moon, but not retiring. I'm moving back to Southern California, to Los Angeles.
Oh wow!
And we'll be doing more directing and even some performing projects down there.
Looking just for warmer climes at this age? Or
I grew up in Santa Barbara, and I spent a good portion of my early adult life in L.A., and it was just time to go back. I still have family down there, and, you know, just time to shake my life up a little bit. Yeah, so
always good. Well, your cast includes Lucas Coleman and Paul Resigno as one pair of the title twins, Antipholus and Dromio of Syracuse, and David Naughton and Robbie Resigno.
Oh, Resigno.
Oh, are they brothers?
They're twin brothers.
Oh, my gosh.
They're identical twin brothers.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Antipholus and Dromio of Ephesus.
Yeah.
Let's get people on board with the plot.
Well, it's years and years ago, there were two sets of twins, the Antipholus twins and then their servants, the Dromio twins. They went out sailing with their father and mother. The ship had an accident, so one set of twins wound up with their father in Syracuse, and the other set of twins wound up in ancient Ephesus. So the Syracuse twins go searching, or have been actually searching for a while. They wind up there, but of course they don't know that they've actually hit the jackpot and that this is the city where the other set of twins actually lives. And so mistakes happen, mistaken identities. Everybody thinks it's one, you know, it's the twins who've lived there for years, and people keep mistaking them. The wife thinks it's her husband, and he's not. The slave's wife thinks it's her husband, and he's not, and spends the night with him. And And so it's just a series of, you know, typical farce, farcical situations that occur. And the whole thing doesn't get wrapped up until the very end of the play when a mysterious woman arrives to reveal all and solve the whole thing for everybody.
Well, it does. It is a story that dates back ages.
It does. There's actually only one line of Shakespeare's play in it, which, you know, the whole cast pops out to point that out, that this is a real Shakespeare line. And George Abbott did the script. It very much plays to the notion of vaudeville, you know, of the 20s, vaudeville humor of the 20s and 30s. And it's tremendous fun. It's just great fun.
Well, we opened with that iconic tune from Rodgers and Hart, sung by Sammy Davis. There are so many great tunes in this show, one of which I had no idea was from The Boys from Syracuse, and it's this tune. And then we'll talk more with Greg McCallum. That shows my ignorance. I always thought that was a Mamas and Papas tune.
No, it's Rodgers and Hart from The Boys from Syracuse. It's interesting. In the show, it's sung by the wife and her servant, who's the Dromio's wife, and her sister, who is being courted by this Antipholus, and she thinks she's being courted by her brother-in-law. So they're kind of ruminating on, you know, how a woman can control her man when he seems to be acting strangely. And it's done in a sort of a Boswell Sisters, Andrew Sisters style. Richard Rodgers hired Hugh Martin specifically to give it a kind of a swing beat that was had not been on Broadway at that point. It was more of a nightclub or, you know, pop sound. And so it's a really fun, in the show, it's a really fun girl group arrangement.
Nice. And let's look back at the Greg McKellen career for a moment. Is there a particular show that you're particularly proud of? I know they're all your babies.
You know, they are, and there are so many. I'm thrilled that we did so much Jerome Kern, because he's unusual in the sense that he's not the glamour name that the Gershwins or Cole Porter are, or even Rodgers and Hart. A show that I was very proud of was Out of This World, the Cole Porter musical from 1951. And we did, I did a new book for it through the permission of the Cole Porter Trust. And we did that twice, and it got produced later in England. So I was very proud of that. But I'm proud all the way, so many, Scrooge in Love, which we just did a world premiere last December. Diane McBride directed that, and it was just a phenomenal show. So there have been actually a lot of shows. A lot of Rodgers and Hart, Do I Hear a Waltz, I was very proud of. And all that Kern. And then we did two United States premieres of Kern's Cabaret Girl and Three Sisters.
Well, that sounds like a show in itself, All That Kern.
Yes, exactly.
It could be a great review.
Yes. We've done a Kern salon evening and a Kern gala evening. So we've done a lot of Kern, and I'm very happy to have done that.
Mm-hmm. Well, we wish you all well down for the move back down to La La Land and environs. And we're not going to go without seeing Boys from Syracuse, this production.
Oh, it's great.
And then after Boys from Syracuse, working on Most Happy Fella.
We are, which has already started rehearsing. Right. Cindy Goldfield's directing that. And that runs for 3 weeks. We have a little bit bigger of an ensemble and cast and a little orchestra for that. And so that's going to be a fantastic show too. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous score by Frank Lesser.
Well, more information at 42ndstreetmoon.org for all things going on there. 42ndst 42ndstreetmoon.org. The boys from Syracuse through the 17th of April. Greg, thanks again for coming in.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
Enduring the bridge. Let's go out with another classic tune of Rodgers and Hart from the boys from Syracuse originally. Here's the unforgettable Nat King Cole and This Can't Be Love.
This can't be love because I feel so well. No sobs, no sorrows, no sighs. This can't be love. I get no dizzy spell. My head is not in the skies. My heart does not stand still. Just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love because I feel so well. But still I love to look in your eyes. Heart does not stand still, just hear it beat. This is too sweet to be love. This can't be love because I feel so well, but still I love to look in your eyes. I love to look in your eyes.
Nat King Cole with This Can't Be Love. That's one of the iconic tunes from the Rodgers and Hart musical, The Boys from Syracuse, at the 42nd Street Moon Eureka Theater through the 17th of April. 42ndstreetmoon.org for more information on that show. Well, earlier I alluded to birthday boy Herb Alpert. Herbert Alpert was born on this date in 1935. He's an American musician most associated with the group variously known as Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, or the Tijuana Brass, TJB. Albert is also a recording industry executive, the A of A&M Records, a recording label that he and business partner Jerry Moss founded and eventually sold to PolyGram. Herb's musical accomplishments include 5 number one albums, 28 albums total on the Billboard album chart, 9 Grammy Awards, 14 Platinum Awards, and 15 Gold Albums. As of 1996, Albert had sold some 72 million albums worldwide. He's the only recording artist to hit number one on the U.S. Billboard Hot 100 pop chart as both a vocalist for This Guy's in Love with You in 1968 and as an instrumentalist, Rise, in 1979. I grew up on this album, Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, Whipped Cream and Other Delights. I have that iconic album cover pictured right in front of me, and it's a tune that I want to share with you, the opening track, A Taste of Honey. On Herb Alpert's birthday. Happy birthday, Herb. Happy birthday, Herb Alpert, and a taste of honey from his iconic Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass Whipped Cream and Other Delights. Well, other delights here in the Bay Area include the San Francisco Symphony this weekend. They're performing under the direction of Michael Tilson Thomas, Copland's Orchestral Variations, Copland's Inscape, as well as the Piano Concerto, and Schumann's Symphony No. 2. Anand Barnatan is the soloist for the Piano Concerto. Copland and Schumann this weekend at the Symphony. Also, the San Francisco Opera Labs, you can eat, drink, and be married. A Serbian bride-to-be and her friends prepare for her wedding day in an exuberant a cappella opera. Michael Cavanaugh directs a new SF Opera Lab production of Anna Sokolovich's compellingly and beautiful transparent score, Svadba Wedding. That's at the brand spanking new Opera Lab space atop the Veterans Building, right above the Herbst Theater, believe it or not. Information at sfopera.com. I'm David LaTulipe. You've been listening to Open Air for this final day of March 2016. A reminder that our programs are archived at our KALW website. Look for Open Air on the drop-down menu. And thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing Open Air. If you've got a segment suggestion, dash me an email, david@kalw.org. Happy April. No fooling. Tomorrow's April 1st.